Night had fallen by the time they arrived at Mind's Eye. The pond had turned into a popular gathering spot. Motorcycles were parked along the hilltops, and people were prowling around the cabins and the church, searching for the supposedly missing kids. Amy figured there were two ways to look at it. It was bad news that so many people were in contamination range of what the Millibut was presumably about to do, but it was good news that they were still searching. It meant the kids hadn't been found yet. John parked a ways away from the church. Its lot was full, and she wondered how they were going to deal with all the bystanders. Ted, David, and Ted's friend jumped out of their truck, and Ted pulled out a pair of futuristic binoculars. Amy figured they were night vision, to scope out the pond and the mouth of the collapsed mine, looking for a giant mantis bat monster. David walked up, pulled her and John out of earshot, and muttered, "You talked to Marconi?" "Yeah. And just to be clear, that is Joy Park, right? We heard people call her that."
"It appears so,"
Amy said. "Remind me who Joy Park is again?" David said, "A porn star we saw on the internet who we don't know and who doesn't live anywhere near here." Amy said, "Is that who was living at John's place?" John scrunched up his face in thought.
"Maybe?"
David said, I mean, is she real? If so, do we even know where she's from? Or how she could get here? Like, does she actually live in Korea? Does she work for the Millibut? Is she going to—" John nudged him to stop talking. Ted was approaching. David said to him, "See anything down there? No sign of the target, but there's a gaggle fuck of bikers wandering around in the way." Amy said, "Do you see any of the missing kids?" Ted shook his head. John asked for the binoculars and studied the area below. He gave a start, as if he saw something, but quickly stifled his reaction. He feigned disinterest and said,
"I can't make out anything. Let's go down,"
in a way that made it clear to Amy that he had seen something, but for some reason couldn't let Ted in on it. She supposed she'd have to be surprised right alongside him. So, they headed down the winding path, hunched over in their jackets while cold raindrops popped on their shoulders. Ted and his partner were going to pack up the bomb and bring it down after them. They had needed to get it inside something, as in its present state, Amy agreed that it was fairly recognizable as a bomb. On the way down, they passed four guys in biker gear heading up the other way, looking like exhausted, tensed-up coils of rage. Near the bottom was a pair of leather-clad women comforting a third who was convulsing with sobs. An entire community having lost their young, or so they thought. If it had been a clearer day and the pool had had time to settle to its usual dazzling shades of blue and green, Amy would have seen right away. But the rain and the gloom meant it wasn't until they were on the shore that she saw him, a little boy, lying face down in the water. She knew what it was. Of course she knew. And still, she ran into the pond after the drowned or drowning child. Stomping through the chilled water, tossing aside her raincoat. She couldn't swim. She didn't care. David screamed and ran after her. He roughly put an arm around her chest and yanked her back. "No, Amy!" He dragged her back out of the water, frantic, and she saw John looking terrified, keeping his distance on the bank. Not even risking putting a toe into the water, not even to help her and David. That's how scared he was of what he was seeing in there, what his eyes saw instead of the endangered boy. John yelled to her, "What do you see?" She tried to breathe.
"A boy,"
she gasped. He had black hair, a dark complexion.
"We have to get him out of there. We'll work out what's happening later, but we have to get him out. He's face down in the water. He can't breathe, David."
John said,
"No. Amy, trust us."
She said, "What do you see?" David said,
"A mouth."
"The boy looks like a mouth? How?"
"No. The whole pond. It's a mouth. The boy, what you're seeing as the boy, it's just a lure, nothing more."
Amy watched as a few tiny bubbles floated up from the child's submerged face.
"He's still alive,"
Amy said. "What if I want to risk it?
If I die trying to save a kid, then maybe that's how I want to go. You see one thing, I see another.
David said, Amy, I can't make this any clearer. That is the point of the trap. Of all this, you're being played.
But it's my choice.
At that moment, a man sprinted past them, apparently having run down the hill while they were arguing. It was, of course, Ted. He flung aside his jacket, ripped off his shirt, and dove into the water. John and David both yelled warnings at him, but even if he could hear them, he had no reason to listen. Even if they could convince Ted the boy was bait, that wouldn't justify letting him drown. Why couldn't they see that?
Then came the sound of more footsteps stomping toward them from behind. Three of the bikers shouting for everyone to follow, to call an ambulance.
Ted dragged the boy out of the water and started giving him mouth to mouth. David's eyes went wide, like he couldn't believe what he was seeing. The boy sputtered and sucked in breath and came to life. Ted almost wept with joy. So did Amy.
John muttered to David, "Call Marconi." 10 minutes later, the police had pushed most of the civilians back up the hill. The three of them were in the front of the church. Nearby, a Hispanic man and woman were babbling and crying and hugging the rescued boy, who sat draped with a blanket on the back bumper of an ambulance. The father was wearing a soaked denim vest with biker patches on the back. He and a street cop were alternately comforting the child and peppering him with questions. David kept dialing his phone over and over, trying to get Dr. Marconi. He'd never gotten an answer and was growing more alarmed by the second.
John said, "Look, even if the Maggie situation has gone south, it hasn't gone too south, or else we wouldn't still be sitting here, right? Maybe he's just, busy with it."
From behind them came a voice saying, "Looks like you geniuses are 3 for 3 on finding these kids. How about that?"
It was Detective Bowman.
John said, "Got almost $300 to show for it. Is the kid talking?"
"He is."
David said, "Is he saying a bunch of weird, creepy nonsense?"
"No, that's Spanish he's speaking. It's a foreign language, you see."
"What did he say? Did he say how he wound up in the pond?"
"He said he swam out."
"Out? To the pond? From where?"
"From inside the mine through a tunnel full of water. He said he was taken inside a cave, along with the others. He said all of them are in there, 9 other kids. Said it was getting hard to breathe, that they're running out of air. Said he got desperate and dove down into a little pool on the floor of the mine, and this is where he popped out."
David said, "That doesn't even sound possible."
The detective shrugged. "I'm not a geologist. I know most kids are lying sacks of shit. But we got a guy at the scene who says there could be a fissure in the earth or something. Leads from the bottom of the pond to somewhere inside the mine. Be hard to see it under the water. But if they're gonna get the kids out, that's how. You try to pull those rocks from the mouth of the mine, all that happens is more rocks fall in. They'd be at that for months."
Amy said, "So you're going in? For the rest of them?"
"Me." Bowman looked back down at the pond. To me, 100-foot-wide gaping maw in the rock, wet flaps of pink flesh like tongues, twitching and curling at the air, surrounding a 2-foot-wide throat, flexing and pulsing as if anticipating a meal.
"Yes, ma'am," he said, and nodded toward a blue van that was making its way toward them. "In fact, dive team's here."
Over at the ambulance, the mother hoisted up the squirming maggot, carrying it like a child. Its mandibles latched onto her shoulder, and blood poured down her shirt. Bowman trotted over to meet them.
John looked back and forth from the maggot to the orifice in the ground. He muttered,
"Wait, I don't think that's its mouth."
In a low voice, I said, "We have to do this, and we have to do this fucking now. We have to get the bomb down there, jam it in, blow up the egg sac, or birth canal, or whatever the fuck part of that thing's anatomy that is, before 9 more goddamn maggots pop out of it."
Amy said, "You see these armed biker guys standing everywhere? They think their kids are still inside that hole. They'll shoot you to pieces if you blow it up with their children still in it. The police, too."
"Well, what we're hoping is that the moment the blast goes off, the spell will be broken.
We sever the Millibots' connection to this world. It'll break the mind control powers of the fuckroaches. Everything will go back to the way it was. Memories of the kids will just go poof. There'll be some confusion, but then everyone will agree we're heroes and give us all free pairs of leather chaps. Amy said, "What evidence do we have that the roaches can't operate independently of their mother?" I shook my head. "Doesn't matter. We have to risk it." She said, "And that's even assuming the bomb works at all. Remember the shotgun that same lady gave you? Plus, we don't actually have the bomb. It's in Ted's truck." I said, "You see the scuba guys getting ready to go down there? I'm going to give us exactly 3 minutes to come up with a plan to deal with all the stuff you just mentioned. Then, we move." Chapter 28. A completely successful plan that ends the story. This is probably the final chapter, right here. Amy. Amy tried to be casual as she passed the camouflage pickup. The bomb was sitting in the passenger seat inside a camouflage backpack, though a completely different type of camouflage than the truck's pixel-style paint job. She wondered what the difference was. Ted's partner, who David had said had a profane nickname, was leaning casually against the passenger side door. She kept walking and circled the little church. All of the cops and most of the bikers were down around the pond now, where the action was. She would have relative privacy for her end of the operation. David had actually suggested she use her taser on Ted's friend. She had transferred it from her purse to her pocket the moment they arrived. But she knew for a fact that it hurt a whole lot, and she also wasn't sure it even had a charge left. It was a last resort, at best. Instead, once she was out of the man's sight, she sucked in as much breath as she could and screamed her head off. Splashy boot steps stomped her direction. The grizzled ex-soldier arrived with his gun at the ready, eyes wide. Amy was pointing at the sky. "It's here! The bat thing! It's here!" He pointed his gun up into the clouds. "Where?" She made a show of desperately trying to study the sky. I just saw it. I saw it plain as day. It went behind those trees. I think, darn it, it knows we're messing with its nest. She turned to look the man in the eye. "It's going to come back. It wants its prey. Have you seen the video of this thing? When it swoops down, it can snatch a kid into the sky in 3 seconds. And that's who it's going to come for, the little ones. Go talk to whoever's got guns. Tell them we need people watching the skies, and I mean every single minute." Poopbeard nodded. "Affirmative." Me. I casually walked past the camouflage truck and snatched the bomb bag from the seat. I shuffled quickly down the steep path and along the way texted John, "Prepare the diversion." We were hoping the blast damage and shrapnel from the bomb would be largely contained in the orifice, but everyone involved in the project was largely unfamiliar with the anatomy at play here. It would be weird if we weren't. This meant that on top of making sure nobody interfered with the operation, we needed to get the innocents as far away as possible, all within the next few minutes. That would be John's job. Someday, he will be remembered as the Michelangelo of loud, baffling distractions. Shitbeard shouted for help with the bat mantis hunt, and some of the bikers came trudging up the hill as I descended, but not all of them. I hustled down toward the pond, knowing I had to beat the rescue divers into the hole. I didn't want to blow the birth canal with a man inside it. That seemed like a super weird way to die. But still, if I couldn't get there first and it came down to one man versus the world, I made it to the bank of what everyone else thought was a pond and waded out into the squishy mass surrounding the orifice, slipping and sliding on slime. The scuba divers were on the opposite shore messing with their gear. Ted was talking to a street cop nearby. No one was looking at me. I pressed on and found myself being resisted by an invisible force, then realized I was wading through a shallow pool of water that I couldn't actually see. But if the water isn't real, someone shouted at me, asking what I was doing. I said, "Just gotta check something, just be a minute." I trudged forward.
I patted John's lighter in my pocket, making sure it was there. It was Amy who had remembered that I needed one, bless her, and reminded myself to lift it out of the invisible water before attempting to light it, just in case it worked that way. We had 3 minutes on the fuse, according to Tasker, though it had occurred to me that may have been bullshit, and the thing might just blow up in my hands the moment I touched it with the flame. The orifice was just ahead, the water now up to my waist. I'd have to hold my breath to get the bomb into place. Maybe? It might have been my imagination, but I thought I could sense something as I got closer. A heaviness in the air, kind of like when you walk into a room and can sense that you just missed a bitter argument, or some illicit porking. Was it fear? No. Power. Menace. Ravenous appetites and strange desires lurking just below, like I was bobbing on an inner tube in the middle of an ocean, while below me swarmed the swift shadows of a vast school of Cthulhus. Despite Marconi's speech, I had still been thinking of the creature as being physically located inside the mine. But now I understood. This particular spot was just where it interacted with our universe, like the microscopic point where two perfect spheres contact one another. This was where our universe touched a sprawling, putrid nebula of dumb loathing and unfathomable, cruel strength. I thought that if it could be expressed as a physical size, the entity would be large enough to swallow our solar system whole. This thing, I thought, had far more than 1,000 butts. I found I had stopped walking, my own fear and invisible hand, to my chest. I shook it off and pushed myself forward. I squished toward the quivering orifice, now about 20 feet in front of me, and muttered, "I've got to get a real fucking job." I pulled out my phone, typed out, "Do it now," and just as I was about to hit the send button, I got slammed from behind, thrown face first onto the squishy pink surface. The bomb went rolling away, still in its backpack, the fuse still unlit. I felt water burn into my nostrils. Could I drown in the illusion? I had no idea. I held my breath anyway. Ted Knoll stood over me, my shirt in his fists. He lifted me up, and I felt myself break the surface of the pond. Ted said, "What the hell are you doing?" He was shaking my torso with each word. I sputtered, "Ending this! Killing the... closing off the nest! There's more kids in there, fuckstick! We got divers here. They're going in after him." I scrambled for a story. I briefly considered the truth. Over Ted's shoulder, I saw Amy up at the top of the path, looking down, hugging herself in the rain. I tried to think of a way to signal to her, but all that came to mind was screaming, "Tell John to start the diversion," which I figured would defeat the purpose of a diversion. I said, "You say you can spot a liar. Well, watch my face real close. There are no children in there." "What? Why would the kid lie?" "It's a trick. It's an ambush. What comes out of there? Ain't nobody gonna survive it, Ted. We've got to close it, and we've got to close it now." Ted let me get to my feet. He then gathered up the bomb, slinging it over his shoulder. "You look like you're lying all the time, no matter what you say. Maybe you're right about this, but if so, it'd be the first time since I ran into you. Dive team knows the risks. I've told them what's what. If something hostile comes out of the water, we'll be ready. But you and your buddies are gonna stay the hell back, up there on the ridge. I see you approach before every one of those kids is free, I'll boot stomp your ass into red waffles. Are we clear?" I thought I could feel the millibut smirking at me from some cold corner of the universe. Ted turned, leaned forward, and waded his way out of the invisible pond. 9 more kids in there. Once the last one is out, then we blow it. Not before. But then, I thought, it will be too late. Defeated, I met Amy at the top of the path. The two of us didn't speak as we made our way around to a spot behind the cabin nearest the church. There, John sat on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle he'd sneaked out of the church parking lot. He had strapped 6 silicone butts to various parts of his torso with bungee straps. He was holding Buddha's mace, which had 6 pink dildos taped to it. I said, "Forget it. We don't need the diversion. I got intercepted by Ted. John looked crestfallen. There were faint cheers from below. We moved back to where we could see the pond just in time to watch a scuba diver crawl up from the twitching pink orifice, a squirming maggot in his hands. Three of them out in the world now, depending on what had happened with Maggie. Speaking of which, I tried Marconi once again and felt my whole body seize up when he actually answered. He said, "David? Jesus! Finally! Tell me you took care of Maggie." "Not yet. There was a complication." "God damn it, Marconi!" Your friend, Joy, began acting strangely. Uh-oh. Yes, not having met her and knowing our situation, I had suggested she be vetted by our crowdsourced array, as you were. "Ah, yeah, not a bad idea." He continued. "As a response, she put a gun to my head. She is still doing it at this very moment." He sounded only mildly surprised by this turn of events. "You never told me how you know this person. Let me guess, she doesn't want you to do away with Maggie." "That would be correct. And in fact, we are on the move. I am not sure to where. Joy is not forthcoming with answers." I said, "I'm going to bet you're coming here, and that she intends to stop us from taking out the thing in the mine." I heard Joy say, "Hang up," and the call disconnected. I squeezed my eyes shut, pushed wet hair away from my forehead, and said, "Well, Marconi has fucked up his end. Now what?" Amy said, "The good news is we still know where every single one of the kids are, right? So, there's that. They're kind of contained, still." "Yes, we can watch them all hatch right in front of us." John said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm very disappointed in the sauce-tripping weekend version of ourselves." I shook my head and let out a long breath. I glanced at the church behind us and for the first time noticed that on the door, in John's handwriting, had been scrawled, "This is a vagina pond." Amy. The rescue went quickly. There were two scuba divers, alternating trips into the fissure leading inside the old mine. At the moment, the last of the 10 children was being hauled from the pond that David insisted was the pulsing birth canal of the Millibut. The rain had slacked off into a light drizzle, which was as close to no rain as they got these days. Amy soon thought that she was going to wake up covered in mildew. The kids were being loaded into a modified Christ's Rebellion school bus at the top of the hill. It was white and covered in red Bible slogans, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty," and at least one image of a cartoon policeman getting run over by a motorcycle. Amy could see the cops talking to the surviving leadership of the biker clan, clearly trying to convince them to bring the kids in to give statements and get checked out at the hospital. She could only hear muffled conversation, but Amy got the sense that the bikers weren't having it. No. These people were done with all that. They were, Amy assumed, done with undisclosed. They just wanted to hit the road and feel the wind of the Lord's liberty on their rough cheeks until they arrived in a better place. "If I change, go. Just go." Amy watched as the kids boarded the bus one by one, guided by biker moms. She had expected, or hoped, the kids would look like perfect Children of the Damned characters. You know, clones. Maggie had been a cute little blonde girl, and Mikey had looked like a big-cheeked black kid from an 80s sitcom. But these looked like, well, biker kids. Rough haircuts done at home. One boy had a shaved head. Another had a mullet down to the middle of his back. Hand-me-down t-shirts, at least one 10-year-old girl wearing a tank top covered in cartoon cannabis leaves. One kid had a splint on his finger, like he'd broken it at some point, maybe trying to catch a baseball. Another had a red birthmark that covered half his face. A chubby little girl had a nasty rash crawling up her neck. Every stitch of clothing, every band-aid, every blemish with its own backstory. She tried not to look at them. Me. I saw Amy staring at the bus and then making a determined effort to look elsewhere. The vehicle was now stuffed full of the larvae. They were squirming all over the windows. The female driver sat behind the wheel smoking a cigarette while a maggot munched on her scalp from behind. Blood ran down her face. She just blithely puffed away, waiting for the last of her cargo to board so she could head out. If just one of them gets out into the world, we're fucked, plain and simple. The last of the children was now free from the mine, and Ted didn't waste any time moving on to the bomb phase of the operation. He and Shitbeard approached the orifice, the former with the bomb backpack slung over his shoulder. Ted had threatened to murder us, or at least me, if we got too close, but we risked moving partway down the path to get a better vantage point. I was very confident the Millibut wasn't just going to let Ted jam a bomb up in there, and I was 90% sure that whatever trick the creature pulled, it would require John and me to run down, rip the bomb from Ted's hands, and finish the job ourselves. I was also curious to see how Ted and Shitbeard operated. I was specifically wondering how they would disperse the bystanders. Detective Bowman and his partner were standing right there on the pond's bank, meat flaps. But Ted just gave the cops a hand signal, and both of them started directing people up and away from the blast site. So he'd just discussed it with them, and they had agreed it was a good idea. Why not, if the kids were safe? Must be weird to actually have authority figures on your side sometimes. Motorcycles were rumbling to life above us, some of the gang already heading out, probably to go start packing up so they could all leave this godforsaken place for good. I briefly wondered if John's meth supplier was going with them. Shitbeard had the night vision binoculars and positioned himself nearby to scan the sky for the Bat Mantis, his assault rifle at the ready. Ted waded out toward the orifice with the bomb, doing a slow-motion walk, believing he was pushing through water up to his chest. Even partway up the hill, I felt a tremor, but not in the ground. It was like the sky and the stars were trembling, a shudder in the cosmos. John gave me a look, and I knew he felt it too. Whether or not that bomb was actually going to work, I was pretty sure the Millibut thought it would. Yet nothing emerged to stop Ted. "Why? I know you've got more tricks up your sleeve, you galactic piece of shit. I'm sure of it. Make your move." Ted lit the fuse, took a deep breath, and disappeared into the pink hole. The phrase, muff diver, did not come to mind then or at any point after, and I'm not sure why you assumed it would. John said, "There's no way it's going to be that easy." Amy said, "Look!" There was a flash of headlights from above. An RV pulled in up by the church, Marconi's personal white and gold tour bus. It skidded to a stop. Marconi spilled out of the side door, looking frantic. He was breathlessly yammering to us as he ran and tried to avoid tumbling down the steep path. When he got within earshot, he said, "Thank goodness, you haven't planted the bomb yet." I said, "We haven't. Ted has. He's, inside the thing, right now. It's going to detonate in like 2.5 minutes. Marconi's eyes went wide. "No, we have to stop it." Chapter 29. The Danger of Acting on Incomplete Information. "What? Why?"
"I am afraid it will take more than 2 minutes to explain."
Joy Park, who we had been told not very long ago was holding Marconi hostage, ran down the path behind him. She shouldered past him and kept running down toward the orifice, yelling, "We have to get it out!" John, Amy, and I were all rapidly trying to figure out if this was, in fact, the right thing to do. But Marconi was already hustling after Joy, so it was either follow them or watch it happen. Ted had just emerged from the orifice, covered in slime, yelling for everyone to clear out, saying there was fire in the hole. In response, Joy was waving her arms and screaming like a maniac at Ted, shouting at him to remove the fire from said hole. Ted looked very, very skeptical. Rather than try to scream a rapid explanation to convince him, Amy had the ingenious thought to simply yell, "We think there's another kid in there!" Ted cursed and dove back in. We all waited around the orifice, hearing faint squicking sounds from deep inside it. We were well within the blast radius of the device. How much time had passed? I was just about to suggest we all flee when Ted squishily emerged from the birth canal for the second time. He was cradling the mucus-covered bomb, which had about 2 inches of fuse left. He whipped out his combat knife and sawed off the fuse at the root. The next time somebody tried to light that thing, they'd only have seconds. Marconi nodded and said, "Very good. Thank you. First things first, please call down the dive team. I'll explain everything. Also, your daughter is up in my tour bus with her mother. Please go to her. She's distraught." He turned to Joy. "Go up and stall the Christ's Rebellion bus. Tell them I need to have a word before they leave with the children. They will be skeptical. Convince them." Ted and Joy headed up the path. John said to Marconi, "Okay, what's the deal? You saying the bomb won't work? Will it work on the larva up there?" "It will work, just not how you think. The brimstone ritual?" I said, "The what?" "The burning sulfur. You're creating literal fire and brimstone. It will, in fact, pierce the larva's skin, as you witnessed for yourself. And that is precisely what it wants. That's what allows it to hatch. It's the final stage in its life cycle." I said, "Its life cycle depends on us happening to invent a sulfur and thermite dildo gun at exactly the right time?" "Not exactly that, but yes." Amy said, "Oh, God, why didn't I see it? The Mikey larva wasn't maturing or hatching or anything else until John shot it. It only hatched because we tried to kill it." Marconi said, "Think of it like a rash. Have you ever been infected with ringworm? You scratch it, it spreads, the spores attaching to your fingernails. To prevent its spread, you cannot scratch the itch," said John, nodding thoughtfully. He looked at me. "Don't let them scratch the itch. That's what I was trying to write on your asshole." I said, "Wait, why would John and I have built that sulfur dildo cannon when we were on the sauce if it was just going to make the situation worse? We should have been under the sway of profound cosmic insight or whatever." John said, "I know exactly what happened. You built the dildo gun. I disagreed with that plan. That's what we were fighting about when the sauce wore off. Looks like you owe someone an apology." "What? Who?" Marconi said, "We had assumed the larva's camouflage was targeted only at the host parents, that it needed the parents only until it completed some life cycle over the course of time. However, I now believe that death, a violent death, is required for its final emergence. It's not as if the concept of transcendence to a higher plane of existence via death or martyrdom is unheard of in our mythology." I said, "So why not take some horrific form that people couldn't resist killing? Why bother looking like adorable kids at all?" "You have to think of a ritual like a chemical reaction. There are specific elements required in specific amounts at specific stages. The offspring feeds on human will, but requires a particular brew for nourishment. Not mere terror, but love, and then betrayal. And the unique brand of fear and hatred that follows that sequence. It's like how we exploit a chili pepper. It develops harsh chemicals as a survival mechanism to deter insects, but we harvest them as a spice." "All right. So what would the consequence be of setting off the bomb in the Millibutt's larva chute?" "We have no way of knowing. But I think it is reasonable to say that the possible outcomes range from no effect at all to an entire egg sac full of unseen larvae hatching simultaneously. What is important is that I have no reason to believe it would actually harm the entity itself." "Well, we can't just let 11 of these bastards out into the world to keep chewing on their parents. So what do we do now?" "Remember my creed. No action from ignorance. We need data, and therefore we need time. So we keep the larvae in a location in which we can control them, and above all,
Keep them safe. He was interrupted by an eruption of gunshots and screams from above. Amy. Amy spun toward the chaos of bangs and screaming children from the hilltop. As it turned out, Nan hadn't abandoned Undisclosed to its fate. They apparently just needed some time to regroup. This, Amy thought, would have been fantastic news 30 seconds ago. The darkness above was illuminated by flashing threads of piercing light, like somebody had dropped a box of fireworks in a campfire. Amy took off up the steep path again, and she had the thought that she needed to get her little noodle thighs onto a stairmaster if she was going to do this kind of work. The creepy black cloaks had traded in their futuristic beam weapons for even more elaborate guns that fired handfuls of that hellish, burning metal. She could smell the sulfur. They had gone right after the school bus. The remaining members of the biker gang, who were not big believers in passive resistance during the best of times, had responded with shotguns. With each shot that was fired, the children inside the bus shrieked in terror. At the moment Amy crested the hill, one of the bikers pounded on the side of the bus with his palm and screamed for the driver to go. Just go. Nan had blocked the road with two of their trucks, but only in one direction. The bus went in reverse and backed up past the church, continuing on the looping road, going backward all the way while the cloaks peppered the front of the vehicle with brimstone. The bikers started hurling buckshot at the cloaks' backs, and in the pitched battle that ensued, the bus slipped off into the night. The boys came up behind her. Amy was about to say, "Thank God they got away," when David said, "Shit, the larvae are loose." John said, "I do think it's time to admit that containment is not our strong suit." The cloaks were retreating to their vehicles, and a moment later, a non-truck rumbled past in pursuit of the school bus, soon followed by a second and a third. There were shouts and the noise of Harley-Davidson exhaust coughing to life, then a chrome line of bikes went snaking down the road after the trucks. Detective Bowman's SUV was next, followed by a squad car, sirens blaring into the night. It was quite the parade. Amy watched the herd of noisy lights disappear into the darkness, and in that moment, the downpour chose to resume. She'd lost her raincoat at some point and couldn't remember when. Cold water ran down her back. David said, "Get to the Jeep, let's go." But no one was answering his call. Amy looked to see where everyone had gone and found John, Marconi, and Joy all huddled together in the rain nearby, all muttering urgent commands to each other, standing over something. Amy went over to them. Ted Knoll was kneeling in the grass. Lying there in front of him was his daughter. Maggie was trying to stifle a cry, taking rapid breaths, her little chest heaving. Ted, in a calm, controlled voice, told her he was going to lift her shirt to get a look. The moment he did so, Maggie started wailing. She had a cluster of smoldering dime-sized holes in her belly. The projectiles were still burning inside her. Tendrils of smoke drifting out. Amy moved closer and could both hear and smell sizzling meat. David walked up and said, "Oh, fuck." Loretta emerged from the RV, saw her daughter, and came apart.
"Oh, God. Oh, God, no. Oh, please, God."
Marconi said, "We have to move her. Get her in the RV, now. I have medical equipment." David clearly seemed to think this was a horrible idea, but still helped haul the girl inside, through the RV's kitchenette, and into that cramped little lounge area near the back. They laid Maggie gently on the narrow fold-out sofa. Her shirt was a crimson rag. John said to Ted, "Don't worry, this guy's a doctor." Ted said, "He looked right at her. Fucker had a mask like a little baby. Looked her right in the eyes and pulled the trigger." "I know, man. They'll keep coming," Ted said. "If I don't stop them, they'll keep coming. Keep her safe, you hear me? You keep her safe, or it's on you." "What? What are you?" Ted turned and ran out of the RV, John yelling after him. Amy sprinted to the door of the RV just as the camouflage pickup pulled up, Ted's army buddy at the wheel. Ted leaped into the bed of the truck, and they tore off after the convoy.
Behind Amy, little Maggie was howling while her father became a shrinking pair of taillights that were quickly swallowed by the night. Amy said, "We have to get her to a hospital." She was interrupted by a gunshot, the glass in the open door exploding right next to her face. Chapter 30. Mobile Surgery. John. A bang and the sound of shattered glass. Everyone hit the floor. Maggie screamed. Dave yelled for Amy and ran to her, pulling her away from the door, telling her to get down. John risked a look through a side window. Non-agent Jocelyn Pusnado's black sedan was parked behind them, engine running, headlights illuminating twin horizontal shafts of glistening raindrops. She was standing behind the open driver's side door, wet shirt plastered against her bosom, aiming a pistol. She fired again, then moved toward the open door of the RV, shooting all the way like the goddamn Terminator, rain steaming off the gun. John ducked. Windows shattered along the length of the RV as her bullets whistled through. From behind John, a female voice said, "Here!" And there was Joy, running out from Marconi's office in the back. She had in her hand the obsidian spear that had been leaning in the corner. She tossed it to him. John hefted it, felt its weight, then sprinted up toward the door. He leapt over Dave, who was still on the floor, shielding Amy with his enormous body. John was far from proficient when it came to spears, but you go to war with the weapons you have. He leaned out of the door. Agent Pusnado hadn't so much as changed her clothes since Ted put an assault rifle round through her sternum. Her white shirt looked like she'd had a mishap carrying a punch bowl. John found the scorched hole in her shirt, just off-center from the row of buttons between her perfect breasts. That would be his target. He flung the spear with all his might, the shaft whizzing through the rain. The obsidian blade plunged itself into Pusnado's chest, right into what John was sure was her still-healing wound. She stumbled back and stopped shooting, but did not die. The agent looked down, let out a groan of annoyance like she was having just the worst day, and tugged the spear out of her chest. She tossed it aside, reloaded her gun, and started walking toward the RV again. John pulled the door closed and yelled, "Get us out of here!" to no one in particular. Joy shoved past him. She threw herself into the driver's seat and started the engine. "Hold on!" They rumbled out onto the main road, Pusnado's bullets clanking off the rear of the RV. When the shots stopped, John got a look in one of the side mirrors and saw the agent hobbling back into her sedan, intending to continue the pursuit. If nothing else, John hoped Nan remembered her at bonus time. Amy. The sound of Maggie wailing in the back was the worst thing Amy had ever heard. Pain and terror and helplessness, a plaintive wail that was absolutely raw and absolutely real. Amy and David clumsily climbed to their feet. David, who looked anxious but clearly was not hearing what Amy heard, glanced back that direction, then looked nervously at Joy, who was pushing the RV to its limits down dark, submerged streets. Amy uttered a question that, considering the context, sounded ridiculously casual. "So, where are you from?" Joy, who was hunched over the steering wheel as if she could make the sluggish RV go faster with body language, smiled. "You're sweet. Phrasing the question that way, I can tell you're cool." John stepped toward them, with that look on his face like he was beginning to puzzle something out. Without a word, he held out his hand. Joy knew what he was doing. She took her right hand off the wheel and held it out to him. John examined it like he was admiring an engagement ring. Four of Joy's fingers came off in his hand. While John held them, they transformed back into one of those worker bug things which sat calmly on his palm. David let out a long breath that carried with it the word, "Okay." Joy, trying to steer with her partial hand, said, "I do kind of need that back." John handed the fudge roach back to Joy. It crawled into place and became fingers again. John said, "Well, That actually makes more sense than any of the other possibilities. At some point during the last weekend, I learned how to control a flock of fuck roaches. That's all. Must have learned to train them or something. I said, is there a larva in there? No. Why can't we see through the disguise? Joy said, because you don't want to, dummy. Amy said, and you forced them to take the form of a Korean porn star. So you could do what with her, exactly? Joy said, ew, no, that would not be cool. David said, and we, trust her to drive the bus? Joy said, it's not that hard, if people aren't distracting you. That's actually not what I... Maggie howled again, and Marconi shouted from the back that he needed their help. They ran to the back, where Maggie's mother was trying to hold the little girl still while Marconi tended to her. Blood was everywhere. It covered the narrow sofa, and it splattered onto the floor. Amy couldn't imagine that tiny body even having that much blood in it. Amy yelled back toward Joy, you're taking us to a hospital, right? Me. Marconi's tan suit looked like he'd just gotten home from a double shift in a butcher shop. Beads of sweat covered his forehead. He said, we can't keep her still. The squealing maggot was thrashing around and growing. The goddamn sulfur pellets were still burning through its flesh, and I thought that if hell was a real place, I now knew exactly what it smelled like. Marconi said to the half-eaten Loretta, all right, run into my office through that door there. On my desk is a large stone bowl. On the shelf to the right of it is a glass jar full of sand. Bring them both to me. To John, he said, hold her still. Marconi had a long pair of forceps that he'd been using to try to fish out the sizzling pellets. To me, he said, I tried to cut the wound wider to grant us better access, but her skin snapped the blade off the scalpel, utterly impenetrable. Then I tried to extract the projectiles. He shook his head and handed me the forceps. I said, what the hell are you doing? No, this is... No. Mr. Wong, I cannot see the patient. I'm seeing a little girl with an abdominal wound. I am not a doctor. You believe a doctor would be more qualified to perform this operation? You're locating the projectiles and digging them out. They are not difficult to find. They are sizzling and glowing like miniature suns. That part was even truer than he knew. The creature's skin was translucent. It looked like a dirty plastic tarp wrapped tightly around 20 gallons of Vaseline. I could see four pellets, each the size of a pea, burning their way down to various depths. The worst was about 2 inches down. Start with the deepest first. John leaned over the monster with his forearms on either side of the surgical site, trying to at least keep the little patch I was working on stabilized. Loretta came back with a bowl and the jar. Marconi poured the sand into the bowl and set it next to me, a place to set the burning projectiles where they would not ignite the interior of the RV and create a 46th deadly problem for us to deal with. I pushed the forceps in and the maggot howled, a noise like a screeching exotic bird being forced through a long section of pipe with a sharp stick. Loretta, watching over my shoulder, gasped and wept. I didn't want to imagine what she was hearing. I had to try to force the wound wider to get the forceps around the sizzling projectile. Impossible. The skin was like thick leather. I could change the shape of the wound, but not make it bigger. Then, when I got the instrument deep enough, I found I couldn't really squeeze the burning ball because the grabby parts at the end of the forceps were the wrong shape to grip a sphere. It kept slipping every time I squeezed, and the maggot howled louder every time I missed. Loretta was offering me panicked, unhelpful suggestions every step of the way. From up front, Joy was yelling something about having caught up to the convoy, and I thought I could hear sirens. Finally, I got the first ball tenuously clamped in the forceps, gingerly drew it out, then promptly bumped my hand and dropped the glowing orb on the sofa. It burned right through the cushion, a little tongue of flame licking up from the spot. I quickly dug out the projectile and dropped it in the sand bowl, John rolling the larva out of the way of the burning cushion.
Marconi slapped out the fire, whipping it with his suit jacket. 3 projectiles left. I was shaking. Sweat was stinging my eyes. The larva continued to swell and pulse. I said, "What if it's already too..." and stopped myself. I wanted to ask what if it was already too late, meaning too late to stop the thing from hatching. But Loretta was standing right there, and she would definitely interpret that the wrong way. I leaned in to start working on the next deepest projectile, then almost toppled over when the RV swerved. Joy shouted, "Hang on!" The windshield in front of her was a kaleidoscope of flashing red and blue lights dancing across streaking beads of rainwater. I could hear sirens and shouts and Harley mufflers. We'd driven right into the chaos. Amy. They swerved again, and Amy had to brace herself against the wall. She stumbled up to the cockpit. Joy had steered them around the scene of a multi-vehicle accident turned pitched battle. Detective Bowman's SUV was on its side, blocking the right lane, exposing its mechanical underbelly. Its red lights were still swirling and flashing across the expanse of rain-splattered blacktop. The tailing squad car had then run into it, its snout crumpled between the SUV's tires. The squad car had on its hood a smoking motorcycle and its enraged rider, the guy having apparently gotten sandwiched between the two police vehicles. The rear tire of the Harley was still spinning, sending sprays of water whizzing across the police car's windshield. Off in the standing water next to the highway was one of the non-trucks, having run off the road. It had a grappling hook and line tangled around one of the front tires. Cloaks were pouring out of it and shooting, pinning down several bikers who had skidded to a stop behind them. The RV got clear of the wreck, and Amy could hear muffled gunshots. The rest of the convoy was just ahead. There were layers to the madness. Directly in front of them was Ted's camouflage pickup. The RV's headlights illuminated Ted, crouched in the bed with his assault rifle. His soaked blonde hair was matted to his skull, his green jacket flapping in the wind. He was in the middle of reloading the gun, and even in the darkness, in a moving vehicle, in a howling rainstorm, the reloading process was smooth and fluid. Practiced hands. His fingers did not shake. Ahead of him was an undulating swirl of taillights belonging to 3 Christ's Rebellion motorcycles that were still in pursuit, weaving back and forth, conducting a running battle with the 2 remaining non-trucks that were side by side, one of them driving with abandon in the oncoming lane. The bikers were shooting at the trucks, little fists of flame popping from their stubby shotguns. The rear windows of the trucks were scarred with white marks where the shots had landed, to no avail. These were military vehicles made to withstand this sort of thing. Directly ahead of all of that was the school bus, a vehicle that simply was not built for speed and thus couldn't get any kind of separation from its pursuers. Also, it was clear that all of them were driving into the flood. They were heading directly toward the river, which meant they were entering neighborhoods that had already been evacuated because their roads were impassable. There was an inch of water over the street, and the next sudden movement could send them hydroplaning off in one direction or another, at which point the top-heavy RV would no doubt go tumbling over, wounded little girl and all. Not that the vehicles involved in the pursuit ahead seemed to care. As Amy watched, the non-truck ahead and to the left picked up speed to overtake the bus. Once it was alongside, it swerved over and slammed into it, the black truck trying to drive it off the road, into the overflowing drainage ditch. The bus swerved, kicked up a rooster tail spray of water with its rear tire, then swung back on the street. That driver, Amy thought, could pilot the heck out of a school bus. Something caught Joy's attention in the side mirror, and she cursed. Headlights. The black sedan of the non-agent racing up from behind. The car sped up past the RV in the left lane, then passed Ted's truck before he had time to register it. The 3 bikers, focused on trying to peel the non-trucks away from the bus full of their precious children, hadn't been expecting an assault from the rear.
The sedan swept into their lane and slammed into the rear wheels of two bikes, sending both careening off the road, flipping and splashing into the standing water. Ted tried to bring his assault rifle around to get a clear shot at the sedan. He fired into its side window. The sedan swerved over, smacking into the pickup and sending Ted tumbling over. The pickup slammed on its brakes, causing it to jerk into the third motorcycle, flipping the driver into the side of the truck and then onto the pavement. Joy yanked the wheel, and the RV swerved to avoid running over the tumbling body of the biker. When she swerved back, they ran over a pair of orange street signs now lying flat in the middle of the road, their stands knocked aside. They both said in all caps, "Bridge out." Me. The Maggie larva was now about 50% bigger than when we started. I could feel puffs of frozen dread pouring from the wound. It was a unique sensation. The best comparison I can offer is if you opened your fridge to realize something was rotten in there, then when you opened the cheese drawer, you found a photo of your mother fucking a Dalmatian. This swelling effect did have the benefit of stretching the wounds slightly, though the pellets were getting deeper by the second. My plan to go for the deepest one first had been idiotic. The idea had been to extract them in order of threat level, but in the time it took to dig it out, the other three had burrowed down just as far. Still, I had the second burning pellet out and clenched in the forceps when the RV slammed to a halt. We all went lurching forward like the crew of the Enterprise when a torpedo hits. I came this close to dropping the pellet right back into the goddamn wound. People were shouting up in the cockpit. John yelled, "What's happening?" Joy said, "Bridge is out." Amy, sounding frantic, said, "They're in the water. They're getting swept away." "Who's in the water?" "Everyone. The cloaks are going after them." I heard the RV door open. John turned and yelled, "Amy, wait." Amy was gone, having run out into the storm to do God knows what. John got up and ran after her. The larva started thrashing under me, John no longer there to restrain it. I screamed after both of them. Neither returned. Two pellets continued to scorch their way into the husk of the larva. The creature squealed and sucked and chittered. Loretta ran over and tried to hold it still, putting her hands in all the wrong places, whispering to the thing that it would be okay, that everything would be okay. From the darkness in the wounds, I thought I could hear voices calling my name. I blinked sweat out of my eyes and went back to work. Amy. The bus was sinking. The children were screaming. The bridge that was out was in fact the same bridge they had stood on a few weeks ago when they were pursued to it from the other direction. This was the spot where she had chucked the soy sauce vial into a current that at that time had already been just feet below the rusty junk bridge that should have been replaced decades ago. Now, the river had overwhelmed the bridge and rolled it aside, rusty beams jutting out of the rushing whitewater rapids to Amy's right. Directly in front of her was the rear bumper and emergency door of the white and red bus, now tipped up toward the sky at a 45-degree angle, the front end submerged in the dark current. The rear wheels were still rolling, helplessly, in the air. Amy had watched the Christ's Rebellion bus try to stop, but it was a lumbering, clumsy beast skidding through a few inches of standing water. It hadn't even been close. The bus had splashed face first into the rushing current, and Ted's pickup had soon followed. Ted's friend behind the wheel had tried to swerve around the bus wreck to the other lane, only to see the pavement vanish from under him. So now, there was Ted, upstream to Amy's left, standing on the bed of his sinking pickup and smashing at the rear window with the butt of his rifle so the driver could climb out. It wasn't working. Amy had the thought that the guy had probably already drowned. Meanwhile, tiny hands were slapping and clawing at the rear windows of the school bus, children and panicked biker moms screaming from within. The hulking black non-trucks had in fact gotten stopped in time, and were now parked on either side of Amy. They were disgorging the black cloaks all around her, ready to finish the job. Behind her was the RV, headlights casting shadows across the chaos in the river. She could hear John shouting something from back there. Then, two more headlights joined the party. The sedan of the unkillable female non-agent. There was a scraping and a groaning.